Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club, and I'm your host for tonight. Our program tonight is The Power of Pull, how small moves smartly made can make big changes. Our panelists tonight are John Seely Brown, John Hagel, and Michael Meyer. I'm going to introduce them to you in just a minute, but I'd like to welcome you all here tonight, and we will be having questions about two-thirds of the way through the program. I'm going to introduce each of our panelists first and then set up a conversation. I'm going to start the conversation with a few questions, but then really turn it over to these three guys for a continuation of a series of conversations that have been going on since the book The Power of Pull came out this spring. I'm very excited about it. It's a wonderful book. We do have some for sale. If we're sold out, we have book plates that the authors will sign tonight, and you will be mailed a book within 2 days. So make sure that you get one afterwards. Now, tonight, our program is called The Power of Pull, and it's based on a book by John Seely Brown and John Hagel and their other co-author. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about this book right now and tell you about the speakers. So John Seely Brown is a visiting scholar and advisor to the provost of University of Southern California and the independent co-chairman of the Deloitte Center for the Edge. Prior to that, he was chief scientist of Xerox Corporation and the director of its Palo Alto Research Center, or PARC, a position he held for nearly 2 decades. While head of PARC, Brown expanded the role of corporate research to include such topics as organizational learning, knowledge management, complex adaptive systems, and nano-MEMS technologies. He was a co-founder of the Institute for Research on Learning, or IRL. John, as he is often called, JSB, is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the National Academy of Education, a fellow of the American Association for Artificial Intelligence, and of AAAS, and a trustee of the MacArthur Foundation. He serves on numerous public boards, Amazon, Corning, and Varian Medical Systems, and also private boards of directors. So if you call him John, we'll know that you don't know him. Anyone and everyone calls him JSB. Our other author tonight is John Hagel. John Hagel III has nearly 30 years of experience as a management consultant, author, speaker, and entrepreneur, and has helped companies improve their performance by effectively applying information technology to reshape business strategies. John currently serves as co-chairman of the Silicon Valley-based Deloitte Center for the Edge. Before joining Deloitte, John was an independent consultant and writer. Prior to that, he held significant positions at leading consulting firms and companies. From 84 to 2000, he was a principal at McKinsey & Company, where he was a leader of the strategy practice. John has also served as senior vice president of strategic planning at Atari, and earlier in his career worked at Boston Consulting Group. He's the founder of two Silicon Valley startups. Our third panelist tonight is a very interesting relationship between the three guys that I'll tell you about in a minute. But our third panelist is Michael Meyer, who's CEO of Adaptive Path, a leading user experience education and design firm. Michael came to Adaptive Path from Frog Design, where he led the company's California studio as general manager, overseeing the firm's physical and digital product design offering. Previously, he started and led the product strategy practice at IDEO's Boston office. Before Myers moved to product development consulting, he served as a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy, running a naval telecommunications facility in Naples, Italy as general manager. Prior to that, he managed the production and testing of shipboard nuclear power plants as a naval engineering officer. Michael has a bachelor's degree in physics from the University of California, Berkeley, and an MBA from the Harvard Business School. He currently instructs at the Rady School of Management, University of California, San Diego. So our program tonight kind of grows out of some events earlier this year, and we had a big edge party for JSB and John that Michael hosted at the Adaptive Path Studios. And that night we had a wonderful conversation between the three of them, and out of that has come a series of conversations that we're going to continue tonight. It's very interesting. If you have read the book, you'll know that there's a lot in that book about what to do. One of the things we're going to be talking about tonight is following up from what the authors feel has been missed in the book, and what are the key points that maybe people have missed in the light of some of the other things that they've been excited about. Part of why Michael is here tonight in conversation with them is that Michael's company, Adaptive Path, actually does a lot of the things that these guys are talking about in the book, and it's led to a very interesting discussion between the three of them. And so we're going to continue that discussion tonight and hopefully have some fun, and then we'll open it up for audience questions. and hopefully have more fun too. So I'm going to start with John Hagel, because JSB told me John always goes first. So, and I don't know if that means John's the straight man for JSB or the brains behind the operation. We're not quite sure. But so John Hagel, can you tell us, just give us an idea for people that aren't familiar with the book, what is The Power of Pull, and what are some of the things that you've learned since the book came out in reaction to the book?
Well, I think at the highest level, the power of pull has to do with the notion of the movement that we see. We call it a big shift in the business world from a world of push, where you basically operate according to forecast and predictions and make sure you have all the resources in the right place at the right time to meet the forecast. In a world that's increasingly uncertain and changing very rapidly, it's much harder to forecast demand. And as a result, we see a need for companies and individuals to find ways to participate in pull platforms that will allow them to draw out people and resources when they need them, where they need them, a much more flexible approach to mobilizing resources. At one level, the power of pull is captured in the subtitle, which is the notion of small moves smartly made can set big things in motion. If you understand the techniques of pull and participate in institutions that are organized around pull, it becomes possible through very small moves to actually mobilize, get a significant amount of leverage to get other people's resources and other people to support your efforts and initiatives, in contrast to a push-oriented world where if you want to set big things in motion, you better have a very deep pocket to get those resources purchased and controlled by you. So that's kind of the high-level view of the proposition in the book. We go through an analysis of very different levels of pull that can be harnessed, and we look at it in the context of individuals as well as firms and ultimately how you can use pull to reshape entire markets and industries. So we cover quite a bit of ground in the book. I think in terms of lessons learned or things that we've witnessed as we've watched people read the book. One of the things was we wrote the book with the intention of not just addressing the needs and interests of business executives, leaders of major companies, but also to try to speak to all of us as individuals in terms of how we're experiencing this changing world around us and what's going to be required to be successful. And in that context, I think we were very concerned that by trying to address two audiences, we might fall in between and not address any audience. We've been very encouraged by the degree to which people have read the book and found it extremely valuable at a personal level. Many people have come to us after reading the book and say it really forced them to reevaluate what they were doing with their lives and their professions, and that's been very gratifying to us that we've been able to reach that level of individual. I think probably on the other side, we've been actually surprised at the degree to which there's been a lot of denial among the business executives. One of the things that we focus on in the book as kind of an opening context for our proposition is that return on assets for all public companies in the United States has actually collapsed over the past 45 years. If you go back to 1965 and look at all public companies in the U.S. and fast forward till today, return on assets has declined by 75%. It's been a long-term sustained erosion in profitability. There is absolutely no evidence of it leveling off, certainly no evidence of it turning around. And the denial that business executives have when confronted with that long-term trend is pretty surprising. I think there's a lot of cognitive dissonance out there. They're so used to focusing on the short-term horizons that these longer-term trends really are very hard for them to really engage on. So that maybe JSB, if you have any.
No, I mean, it's been, I think, a shock to us. In fact, if you go to an executive and say basically we've looked at, 20,000 companies, that basically almost without counterexample, the decline of ROA has been truly dramatic and we have parsed this data in many, many ways. We know how to play tricks with data. Actually, this data is pretty clean. The results look pretty robust. And you would think that executives would be terrified by this result. In fact, if you extend this line to its logical conclusion, it hits the zero axis in about 20 years, which it kind of says America is going out of business at that point in time. Now, of course, it doesn't have a linear extrapolation. But so you would think that people would say, well, they first deny it, and they find all kinds of reasons why our analysis aren't right, almost without fail. Whatever they say actually makes our argument stronger. Typical type of thing is, well, you're not counting intangible assets. Well, if you do count intangible assets, the slope goes even faster. And so it's kind of a very interesting form of denial. More interesting to us is the general feeling is, well, America maybe is coming out of the slump, so we're okay. And they're not particularly interested to say, well, maybe we are, maybe we aren't coming out of the slump, but beneath this is a much deeper story. And it's not terrifying once you understand the deep structure of what's going on, and there are all kinds of ways to play this thing out in a very interesting way. So, for example, the subtitle of our book, we carefully chose because these problems are relatively easy to solve, or they really empower both the individual and the corporate world in brand new ways if you're willing to kind of use new types of technology, for example, social media. So one of the surprises I think we've found is you can go in and tell some stories, we'll get back to some of those stories maybe later, of how a very simple use of Twitter inside a very conservative corporation by the younger folks have produced incredible results that have been completely recognized inside the company, but they're completely at a loss to begin to understand how can this be. And in this particular case, one of the stories we often tell in gory detail, the CTO kind of understood that this was not just a question of technology. This is a question of fundamental misunderstanding between two worldviews, the worldviews of the senior partners and the worldviews of the associates, and began to see his role of how do I bring these two communities together and start a conversation between them under the premise, the correct premise, that both have something to learn from the other. And so, for example, one of the surprising things we come up with, executives ask us, what can we do about all kinds of things like this? And we introduced the notion of something as simple as reverse mentoring. Now, all corporate executives know about the role of mentoring. That you take young people and they study under the top execs. What about reversing that entire thing? In today's world of the big shift, in many ways today's kids are kind of more in tune with how to play this game than those of us that have gray hair. And so how do we start thinking about reverse mentoring? And yet they think it's, wow, that's a cute idea. They don't use the word cute, but that's an interesting idea. But then they kind of say, how do we go about doing that? And it seems kind of terrifying, and so on and so forth. We can tell you lots of examples as we go on, but these are just some of the things that, you know, have really hit us even in the first few weeks of going out on the road talking to people.
So, Michael, did you want to comment on that? Or actually, maybe can you tell us a little bit about what you find in your business that relates to this and why you guys feel aligned on this?
No, actually, I kind of wanted to ask a question on that. This idea of denial,
yes,
I think is kind of interesting. I mean, do you find the denial, do you find the sure ROA is declining, the industry is, the world is going to pot, but it doesn't apply to my company or it doesn't apply to my industry? I mean, do you find that kind of argument a lot?
No, I think that was one of the key kinds of pushbacks was, well, this is an average. You know, it's an average for all public companies in the U.S. economy, but, you know, we all know averages can be misleading, and maybe it's one industry. Maybe it's the automotive industry that's dragging everything down, and if we look at everything else, things will be just fine. It turns out, so we responded to that, and we said, okay, let's pull apart the U.S. data into 13 different industries and look at the data at an industry level. It turns out when you look at it at the industry level, 11 out of the 13 industries have experienced this severe and sustained erosion of return on assets. There are only two industries that have bucked the trend, and those, no prizes for the guess. One is aerospace and defense, and the second is healthcare. Everybody else has experienced this extraordinary deterioration in performance. And I think part of it, you know, I'm a big believer that we're all driven by psychology, and part of this, as JSB mentioned, is we are coming, hopefully, out of a short-term downturn, an economic downturn, and I think everybody psychologically just wants to hear good news. They want to hear the news about the recovery. They don't want to be confronted with the story that actually there's something much more severe that's been going on behind the scenes that nobody has seen before. So I think part of it is just the notion of, you know, I can't handle any more bad mm-hmm. news at this point. But I do think that it's an interesting issue that executives really have not been able to get their minds around. And by the way, the media, the print media and the broadcast media, it's remarkable. Everybody has seen the numbers. Nobody, to our knowledge, has found any way to challenge the numbers, and yet nobody has covered it. And yet every day you read the newspaper, you read the business trade press, it's all about the recovery. How big is the recovery? How steep is the recovery going to be? Mm-hmm. There is no mention of this longer-term trend.
It might be worth kind of revealing the mystery of what is going on down there in the deep structure. I mean, because we haven't actually said it yet, so why don't you?
Well, there are a lot of factors that are contributing to this. Certainly one of the elements is simply that there is an intensifying competition by a standard metric that economists use over this time period in the U.S. economy. The competitive intensity has basically doubled. So that's certainly a factor. For those of us who are believers in markets, though, and I am one, you would imagine that markets are innovative engines. They can find ways to respond to increasing pressure, and they would find a way to turn this around. Certainly over 45 years, that's a long time to be confronted with this and not yet find any kind of innovative approaches to dampening that trend. And so it leads us to the belief that actually it's not just about competition intensifying, it's about competition changing. The basis of competition is shifting in such a fundamental way that it challenges the basic assumptions we have about how we run our businesses. And the core way that we condense this is the notion that historically, for the past century at least, we have run our businesses around the model of knowledge stocks being the source of economic value. The whole game in business was to find a proprietary set of knowledge, aggressively protect that knowledge from anybody else accessing it, and then very efficiently extracting the value from that knowledge over an extended period of time. Created huge corporations, a lot of wealth, very successful. Therefore, very hard to challenge as a core set of assumptions. Our belief is that as you move into a more intensely competitive global economy, the interesting thing about knowledge stocks, anything we know today is going to depreciate at an accelerating rate. And so if all we do is hold on to that knowledge and protect that knowledge, we're going to be protecting a depreciating asset. The challenge and the opportunity is to move to a model that says it's all about knowledge flows. Actually, the core value of knowledge stocks is to help you participate in knowledge flows, to connect with people who have new insights, new experiences that can help you refresh your own knowledge stocks at an accelerating rate. That's a very contrarian view to most business executives. Just as an example, when we start to talk about this with a business executive, they'll often say, I got it, knowledge flows. I'll go out and schedule meetings with the 20 smartest people in my market or industry, and I'll get them to tell me everything they know about the market or industry, and I'll get lots of knowledge flows. But I can't share anything that I know with those executives because that's proprietary knowledge. I'd lose my competitive advantage. Well, you can imagine how long those kinds of conversations are going to last. They're not very lasting. If all you're doing is being a taker of knowledge, people lose interest pretty quickly. So it is a challenge.
I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting how true we found that to be. And I think that we've kind of stumbled into this different way of working with knowledge and thinking about what the value of knowledge is, really just from our own desires to be part of the community, to spread the word, to build, to share what we know so that other people can build upon it. It's just, you know, it's one of the premises or the fundamental tenets of the design field is that we build on the ideas of others. You know, the classic model, though, of a design consultancy is that you go out and you get as many projects as you can, as many clients as you can, hire as many junior people as you can, and bill as many hours of their time as you possibly can. And you know, there are traditional sort of metrics and targets for that. And I remember when I first started at AP and started kind of digging into this, and I realized, wait a minute, we have a target of half what everybody else has? How does that work? And what do we do with the rest of our time? And wait a minute, we hold events where we teach people to do what we do on our consulting projects. How does that work? And why would we be giving this away? And you know what we've discovered is that the giving away forces us to come up with fresh stocks of knowledge, right? And it because the reality is, I mean, at least in the design community, it is so porous. Everybody is so connected to everybody else. If you wanted to keep something, some new technique, a secret, you couldn't possibly do it. You know, designers will go out and over a beer, they'll tell everything.
True in the research, too.
Yeah. There you go. You know, so it's just kind of an embracing of that just natural human interaction and just going ahead and giving away what we know. It forces us to come up with something new. And it also forces us to set aside that time so that people can actually come up with something new, right? And that's why we only spend half of our time on work for clients. The other half is teaching or coming up with new techniques or going to conferences and trying to find out new techniques from other people or just sharing what we know and seeing how they'll build upon it. And it's funny because it's something that I think that we just stumbled upon because we naturally like to talk, we naturally like to teach, we naturally like to be kind of at the cutting edge of the interesting stuff that people are doing. And it sort of accidentally almost turned out to be very commercially successful.
And you know, in this world of, in fact, you know, accelerating change, and change is going to be with us for an awful long time, which is constantly disrupting things, you would think that the following piece of advice would be obvious, but it's something that the corporate world has found very hard to accept, and that is the absolute importance of those of us in the corporate world, in any world, in fact, is to be willing to get out of your comfort zone some of the time. Mm. We get stuck in ruts. In fact, organizations have things called organizational routines. You know, organizations are defined by a set of organizational routines. Almost by definition, a routine is something that runs in a rut. So part of the question here, part of the game in terms of how to participate in these new types of flows, is how do you expose yourself to ideas that you might find quite uncomfortable? Mm-hmm. How do you actually engage in things where you're no longer the expert? And how do you actually open yourself to putting out a provisional idea so that you can actually get some feedback before you've thought it all the way through? So it sets up almost a form of reciprocity, where now I can have a real conversation about something that I don't already know the answer on, and so on. And so this whole kind of set of issues of how do you participate in flows in a way that you can hear something that, A, you might not want to hear, B, that might not make sense right away, and C, that you kind of start to learn how to ask questions and actually engage in, which is, I think, half of the game in terms of design literacy, a form of deep listening. How do you actually listen to things, kind of what's not being said? You know, in many ways, when we opened this thing, you asked, what did we learn? Well, some of the things we learned are the questions that we weren't being asked by people that have read the book. Often silences tell you more than what's actually explicitly said or asked.
So what are some of the things that people are not talking about? I mean, you told me in an earlier conversation, the second half of the book, where you really get into how you do it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the second half of the book actually tries to move these kind of fairly deep conceptual ideas into action. That already is a little bit different because most books just tell you either stupid actions or, you know, highfalutin ideas. But our game is to say, you know, at the individual level, at the corporate level, and actually at the regional level, what are some of the things you ought to start doing? And so, for example, we're really struck by a particular person who we talk a lot about in the book called Jack Hittery, or Hittery as he pronounces his name. I don't often pronounce names right. That's why Brown is such a simple name. he has a practice of every year going to some conference that he knows nothing about but is in a domain in which he thinks could become important. But he actually has routines for how to do that. He will go to a 3-day conference, and the first day he always attends all the talks. The second day, he hangs around the coffee tables, listening to how people casually talk. So they're picking up, you know, the ideas and the speaking patterns or the genres of conversation, if you wish. And then the third day, he will have gotten some ideas himself, and he will really put himself at risk of seeing like a fool by asking questions, imposing ideas, in order to figure out how to actually have rich conversations in a domain which 2 days earlier he knew nothing about. And it's dramatic to see what has come from this. If you follow Jack, he has now built from a one meeting he went to, a 3-day meeting, was in the energy problem. He knew nothing about the energy problem they were facing in this country. He is now the father of the carbon war room that had put together some of the most powerful players to find very innovative techniques to attack our energy problem. He's also the person that got Mayor Bloomberg in New York to build the hybrid taxi program, where now half the taxis in New York are hybrids, and so on. And so from that experience, he then went the next step into action through, again, being willing to make mistakes, expose himself, but to have the passion to just get out there and try things.
You know, I think this idea of conferences is really interesting. And I was struck when I was reading The Power of Pull how much time and discussion you all devoted to the importance of attending conferences, especially conferences that are outside of your normal industry, outside of the normal circle of people that you hang with. Because I think that most people think of conferences and they think, ah, Jesus, you know, another stale conference room with bad food and people that I know from the last conference that I went to and the same industry talks that I always hear. And I hear some people chuckling, so apparently you're attending those conferences. Because we approach conferences in a fundamentally different way. Every single person in the company has got a conference budget that they can spend to attend whatever conference they want. And it's literally whatever they want. And we also think that there are some conferences that are like so important that we're going to set aside extra budget for that and ask people, would you go to this one, because we think it's important. But it's always amazing to me the connections that people come back with when they go to these conferences. I was, for example, I was off at the BIF conference just last week. You know, and it's all about storytelling and people from widely different industries and backgrounds telling stories about, like, you know, what they're up to and interesting right. things that they've done. And I had this, I was listening to, I'm afraid I forget her name, but she had recently retired as deputy director of the CIA.
Carmen Medina,
yes. Yeah. Wonderful woman. And she was telling a story about, you know, being a person who thinks very differently inside of an organization who thinks very much the same way. And she made just a kind of a tangential reference to this thing called Intellipedia, which was this notion that, you know, all of these different intelligence organizations ought to come together and use this community forum to share insight and analysis and pieces of data, and that would somehow make intelligence analysis much more effective. And of course, everybody, you know, was like, "Ooh, we can't share our intelligence analysis," and you know how that became actually a successful tool in improving our intelligence. And as I was listening to this, it was like a light bulb went off inside my head, because we have been wrestling with this thing. Imagine, if you will, a group of 50 intensely creative people all trying to agree on what is our creative strategy. Right? Everybody comes from a different background. Everybody has a different creative interest, the thing that is most interesting to them at the moment and that they think is the future of interaction design or design technology or visual design or whatever. And trying to apply this model of, okay, we're going to elect a couple of us to be the smartest people and come up with a creative strategy and roll it out, and everybody's going to be happy with it, which we've tried. You know, we're stupid enough to do that. And it's just never gained any traction. And as I was listening to this idea of the story of Intellipedia, I was thinking, oh, okay, creative Stratopedia. If we could just have a forum where everybody just dumps in everything that they think is the most interesting thing happening, or the future of the creative side of what we are doing. We haven't actually tried it yet, but I've been talking it around with some folks, and everybody that I talk with kind of lights up at this idea of this just community platform for hammering out our strategy, which is, you know, if you think about the way that most companies hammer out a strategy, that's definitely not it.
Now, notice you're talking about building a platform. And that kind of a platform is a simple little example of a pool platform, that you're pulling ideas from the community, consolidating them so people can look at each other and finding some techniques and tools and a platform, so to speak, that makes that easy. And part of the problem is we don't find ways to just do things easily. There's always too much work to do something. And how do you really make this part of the natural discourse of the day?
I do think, too, that's one of the misunderstandings that for people who have not read the book, when they just hear the title, is a reaction of, well, wait a minute, you know, pull's been around for decades. We all know about Toyota and lean manufacturing and pulling inventory when you need it, pulling products when you need it, supplies when you need it. Yes, that is a form of pull. The problem is that it, so far at least, it's only been able to be implemented in a very narrowly defined set of participants. You can only execute a pull logistics system if you have very tight relationships with a few key partners. What we're talking about here are these pull platforms that are highly scalable, that scale to very, very large numbers of participants. In some cases, millions of participants on these pull platforms, where they're drawing out people and resources when they need them, where they need them. That is a very different approach to business relative to even the pull logistics systems.
And capitalizing on the diversity they're in.
Yes, right. Oh, exactly.
So, John, we had I'm not going to get into audience questions yet, but I've had about three of the audience questions are asking for a very simple definition of what is pull. What do you mean by pull? Now, you just gave us half that answer, but maybe you and JSB could give us, for people who haven't read the book,
sure,
what that means exactly.
Well, again, at the highest level, pull is essentially the notion of how do you draw out people and resources when you need them and where you need them. And that's a high level. It's pretty abstract. We talk about three levels of pull that are becoming increasingly important. The first level of pull is what we call access, which is simply finding things when you need them and where you need them. So think of Google as a classic example of a pull platform. We, you know, have become so attached to it, it's very hard to imagine world pre-Google or pre-search engine. But in fact, there are other kinds of access platforms that are being created and managed around the world. We talk about a company in China called Lianfeng, which operates in the apparel industry. They have created a pull platform for apparel designers that connects those apparel designers with more than 10,000 business partners on a global scale. So no matter what kind of apparel you want to manufacture, they have all the specialists in that particular item of apparel wherever you need them in the world. That's a very powerful form of pull that is very contrary to the traditional kinds of logistics systems or supply networks. That's the first level. Now, at some level, that's probably the least interesting. The second level becomes much more interesting and valuable as we move into a much more uncertain world, which is the notion that in an increasingly uncertain world, we're not even sure what questions to ask, who to look for. What is it out there that could be extraordinarily valuable to us if only we knew that they were out there? And so it gets to the notion of attraction as a second level of pull. How do you attract people and resources to you that you didn't even know existed? And many of us talk about it in the context of serendipity. It's that unexpected encounter. We've all had that experience where we run into somebody, we have a conversation, we find out they're doing something that's quite relevant to the work we're doing and extremely helpful, generates an insight. If only we had known that they existed, you know, that's the reaction. Our proposition is that most of us tend to view that as pure luck. It happens when it happens, and the best you can do is be prepared for it when it does happen. We actually make the case that you can shape serendipity. You can increase the probability and the quality of those unexpected encounters through choices you make about where you spend your time and how you spend your time. And so that's becoming increasingly central as a second level of pull. And then the third level of pull for us becomes the most interesting of all, which is how do you pull out of each of us as individuals and as institutions our full potential? That gets to learning, it gets to rapid performance improvement, and using those first two levels of pull to drive more rapid learning and performance improvement. And ultimately, we think that's where the real power is for us as individuals and for businesses, if we can only figure out how to participate in the scalable platforms that focus on that third level of pull.
You know, I think this notion of serendipity and shaping serendipity is, to me, it's a very powerful one and a really intriguing one. And I think one that people are naturally kind of scared to employ. I mean, I think about when, you know, back when I was a young naval officer and I was living in Italy, and all of the other Americans, you know, would end up living in the American part of town around all of the other Americans, going to the restaurants that all of the Americans went to, you know, and learn about 10 words of Italian and you know, not really have a very rich experience. And I remember just, you know, looking for an apartment and finally finding the best place to live, which was this little downstairs in-law apartment with an Italian family in this cul-de-sac where everybody was related to everyone else, and nobody spoke a word of English. And it was the most wonderful experience. I mean, I sort of became part of the family, invited over to Sunday pranzo, the Sunday lunch where the family gathers together, and there was this one point where I went from being invited to being expected. And the day that I didn't show up for Sunday lunch and just got, you know, told what's what by mom. But, you know, putting yourself into a position where that kind of serendipity is more likely to happen. I think that people maybe are at a little bit of a loss, like how that can apply to their personal life, and maybe a little lacking in the courage to actually do it.
And, I mean, part of the problem is that we have notions of serendipity as just being luck.
Yeah.
So the primal meaning of serendipity to many of us goes against even the notion of how do you orchestrate or how do you shape serendipity. I mean, orchestrate luck, it almost is a, you know, an oxymoron, linguistically speaking. And yet, you know, once you kind of peel back the onion, there are many, many things that we can do to actually do that. And I'm very kind of fond of, I watch actually John do some certain things on Facebook. And how do you put out beacons that actually reveal what you're now getting interested in? Mm-hmm. Enough of yourself is there so they can embed that interest in a sense of who you are. And that actually then gets, often attracts people coming back in and saying, I didn't know you were interested in this, but, you know, I've been following your stuff very casually, and let's have a conversation. And so it's kind of, you know, actually you changed my view, I hate to say it, but of Facebook. I had a very simplistic view of Facebook. But, I mean, you know, the number of times you have done this and found really amazing connections with amazing ideas that kind of came up by your willingness to do that.
But it does require putting yourself out. I mean, that's one of the things that, again, I think does make most of us very uncomfortable is how do we expose ourselves? And in particular, I think it leads to something that is very difficult for virtually all of us, which is exposing vulnerability. I mean, how do you, if you want to attract people to you that can be very helpful to you, it sure would be nice to know the kinds of problems you're wrestling with that you don't have an answer to. And yet we're all taught in business, you know, you go out and you put out the strong face, you emphasize that you're in total control of the situation, that you've accomplished all these great things. Don't ever talk about your weaknesses, God forbid, or things that you don't know or that you're puzzled about. And yet that's absolutely essential in these social networks to really draw out relevant people and relevant ideas. Is it helps them, as JSB said, set out the beacons to say, I'm really wrestling with this problem. I'm not sure how to tackle it.
You know, part of your willingness, though, to be able to do this, to put yourself out there, actually stems from a topic we talk a lot about that people seem a little bit surprised by at first, is the absolute importance for passion in terms of a passionate desire to achieve extreme performance. And if you're not really driven to be really great at something, then you're much less likely to find any purpose for putting yourself out on the edge. But if, in fact, your real passion is to get an extreme performance, whatever that is, music, math, whatever, you know, you're less likely to be willing to put yourself at risk, so to speak. And so somehow the importance of passion today in this world of constant change makes you much more at home with being willing to kind of accept and maybe even embrace the challenges that are always coming at you in a changing world in the domain that you happen to really want to be able to achieve extreme performance in.
What's really interesting, this again I think was something that was a bit unexpected to us as we reflect on what we anticipated in the book. We had as a sub-theme in the book the increasing importance of passion in our work. And for many people, this was kind of, you know, why are you talking about that? And yet almost invariably, when we talk to people about the book, that's one of the topics they keep wanting to come back to. Tell me more about that. What's that all about? And particularly the tie that we make, you know, many executives, when I start to talk about passion,
roll their eyes.
Well, they ask me where I'm from, and I say, I'm from California. And then they say, ah, we understand. You're one of those new age types, and, you know, you're into that. Okay. And we say, no, this came out of research where we looked at environments and arenas where there is extreme performance improvement over time. And what are the common elements across those arenas? One of the common elements is the participants are deeply passionate about what they're doing. And so we've done a fair amount of research around this in terms of the workforce. It turns out only about 20% of the workers in the United States are passionate about the work they're doing. So 80% are not. Now, does that matter? One of the things that it does matter on is this notion of connecting. We looked at connecting in a variety of dimensions, going to conferences that are related to your business, going to participate in social media, going even out to lunch with somebody who's related to your work but not in your company. If you look at activity around connection, passionate workers are twice as connected. They're not just a little bit more connected. They're twice as connected as the other workers. So if knowledge flows are increasingly the source of value creation, if you do not have passionate workers, or if you yourself are not passionate about the work you're doing, you're not going to be as connected, you're not going to have access to the same kinds of knowledge flows that passionate workers do. So for us, it's front and center as one of the key issues and imperatives for companies and for us as individuals. One of the key messages in our book for individuals is you need to find a way to integrate your passion with your profession. If you don't, you will experience increasing stress and you're ultimately going to burn out, because the fundamental message of our book is pressure is mounting across the world. It is not going to go away. This is not about a temporary recession. These are about long-term changes that are playing out in the world economy. And if you are not passionate about the work you're doing, that pressure is going to kill you. So you got to find a way to integrate your passion with your profession. There are many ways that can be done, but that's a key imperative for us.
And so, Michael, how do you find that working out for Adaptive Path?
Well, it's funny. I was actually just going to say it's interesting to think about or to look at examples of how you can actually institutionalize that passion. Because I mentioned that one of the things that we do is we hold these events where we give away what we know how to do, and that forces us into developing new methods to moving into working in new media or working on experience design problems in new industries or product types. So the question is, okay, so how do we advance the cutting edge of practice? We have an R&D practice, and we budget a certain amount of our collective time to what we call R&D projects, which are, let's work in a new industry, let's work on a new product type, let's try out some new design techniques or some new engineering techniques, and see what we can learn about it, and also create, because, you know, as a design consultancy, you want other people to bring those projects to you, create the materials that will demonstrate that we actually know how to do this, right? And the requirements for an R&D project getting the okay to go is there has to be somebody who really wants to do it. Like, it has to be the most important thing to them, and they have to get however many other people they need to have on their team, they need to get those people excited to devote their time to it as well. So it's fundamentally different from the model that many companies have, that you have a certain percentage of your time to work on whatever project is interesting to you, which I think is a great idea. But what that doesn't do is it doesn't leverage the coming together of a creative team surrounding that passion. And what we've found is, because we've tried it both ways, right? We've tried to say, this is a skill we need to develop, and you guys are going to work on a project to develop that skill, and it doesn't work, right? When we try it, when we say, okay, we have time for some people to work on developing a new skill, who's got an idea that they really feel strongly about? Those are the teams that are just blazingly successful.
Okay, well, we've reached a point in our program now where I think we're going to turn it over for audience questions. I'd like to let our audience listening at home know that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our program tonight is The Power of Pull with John Seely Brown, John Hagel, and Michael Meyer. Well, we had about three or four questions about open source, saying how does pull relate to open source, and How does this pull notion relate to the concept of open source? Are the risks of pull similar? Or if not, what are the risks? JSB, what do you think of that?
I think that some of the most successful open source projects actually are built around the notions of pull platform, where we can actually get the ideas of multiple people coming together, working together often in joint activity to build things in a way that each of us can learn from what the others are doing. I mean, something that's not talked much about the open source community is, if you're going to be a successful participant in open source, you have to write code that is meant to be read by somebody else. Now, some of us were trained to be a computer scientist, that's my training, and we thought we were heroes if we could write code that no one could possibly figure out as long as it worked. Okay, you know, the open source community completely inverts that. And I think that turns out to be a very beginning building step for then being able to have other people be able to come in, improve that code, and in that process of improving that code, they become more central members of the community of this open source. So one of the things that we don't talk much about in open source are, what are the pathways in? What are the ways that you bring new people in? How do they build reputation in this community and so on? Some of the risks of open source are actually handled according to, in some ways, the constitution for each open source project. mean, the thing that's never talked about is opening major open source projects actually have rules, regulations that they create, they buy into, they're kind of often group negotiated, although not always, that helps to do, dispute adjudication, decide when you can fork a system, who gets to actually do the releases, and so on and so forth. And I think that the catch in the types of creation spaces, which is our equivalent in our theory of pull to some aspects of these open source, is, you know, how do you actually structure interactions and kind of almost, you know, miniature constitutions that govern what legitimate actions are, what you can do to complain, how do you adjudicate disputes, and so on. These are not just hairy-fairy self-emergent systems. These systems have structure. The irony is they never get talked about. Same with open source. They don't get talked about. If you go back to John's example of Lian Vong, which is one of the most productive kind of creation spaces in the world today, they have some very simple principles that actually could go back to your design firm, too. One of the principles in Lian Vong's, 10,000 companies participate in this ecosystem around the world, is that basically Victor Fong, or Lian Fong, will say, if you get into our network, if you get accepted, here are the rules you have to operate by in terms of quality, safety, work practices, and so on. But most importantly to us, if you come into our network, we will guarantee that we will always take 30% of your output at a minimum, but we will never, ever take more than 70% of your output. Because we want you to work with our competitors. We do not want you to become subservient to us. And likewise, we don't want to drive total dependence on you either. Now, this sounds like a very strange idea, except you realize that when you do that, trust is accelerated. The building of trust really speeds up. And so part of the game in terms of how these pool platforms have to work is, how does trust get built? How do you accelerate the building of trust? Because if you can't build trust, then the transaction costs go through the ceiling. So, some of these things sound almost impossible, but simple moves like that, and that's a relatively simple idea, changes completely the social and psychodynamics of what goes on.
I just add, relative to the question, I think there often is a misunderstanding when we talk about knowledge flows versus knowledge stocks, that we're advocating giving up intellectual property and everything becomes a free resource to everybody else. And that is certainly not the case of what we're suggesting. There are some very interesting environments like open source where there's a very different approach to intellectual property management. But some of the most interesting pull platforms today are in environments that are very protective of intellectual property. Staying in the software industry, there's a company, SAP, a very large company, that has created an amazing pull platform that now engages over 2 million software developers around the world in this pull platform, and yet they have managed to protect the intellectual property rights associated with the various initiatives. Incentive, which is often talked about as a pull platform, very interesting pull platform. One of the key things they have thought deeply about is how to structure the rights to the intellectual property that's created as part of the interactions on the Incentive platform. So it's not that intellectual property goes away or that knowledge stocks become irrelevant. It's that knowledge flows are becoming more and more the focus for value creation, and that's where you need to focus your efforts.
And like with Incentive, the techniques to bring ideas on the edge quickly to the center so that you can really capitalize on extreme diversity, or practices that have been developed for some completely other reason unexpectedly play out in the particular challenge that you are operating on now.
I think the idea of not being greedy about intellectual property rights is really important as well. I mean, one of our principles is that we provide everybody in the company who is interested in, and hopefully everybody in the company is, a platform to build their own personal brand, right, within the community. And that means that they need to have some ownership of the materials that they create. Mm. It becomes a part of their persona. It becomes a part of their professional persona. It needs to be something that they feel ownership of and that they will actually derive some greater benefit from. We just trust that we're going to derive a benefit from it as well and are more than happy to share, with them the capital that's created.
Thank you. There's another question. Is there a timeline for executives coming out of denial? Is this similar to our climate change challenge? John?
It's a great question. I think one of my favorite quotes is by one of my favorite authors, William Gibson, which is, "The future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed." We can find companies today that do understand the power of pull and are aggressively exploiting the potential of that power. So it's not that all of a sudden everybody's going to realize that there's a problem out there. And in fact, part of the opportunity here is for those who are early into this and demonstrating the power of pull, it becomes a magnet to get the attention of executives who are under increasing pressure in a world of push and looking for alternatives, ways to deal with that in a fundamentally different approach. So our sense is that it will take time. This is not going to happen overnight. But one of the things that does give us confidence is that the opportunity to scale change, even within a very large corporation, is shifting in a fundamental way, and that initiatives around pull that are executed on the edge of a large enterprise can scale much more rapidly than has ever been possible before. And so once executives start to understand the potential of pull, there are approaches to move very rapidly, but pragmatically. Again, I think what we would never want to be interpreted as saying you got to blow everything up and start all over again. Part of the power we see of pull is that it can be executed in rapid stages that lead you to a very different kind of world out there, but don't require you, that are pragmatic, that recognize that you can't ask people to make huge investments and wait 10 years before there's a return on that investment.
Any other comments on that? Well, here's another question, which is pretty straightforward. Are there companies today, other than social media companies, who are actually practicing or implementing the principles of pull?
Yes, and it leads to...
Give them the test.
It leads to one of our most provocative propositions in the book, which is that the global center of innovation is shifting from the United States to China and India. In fact, we've had research teams spending a lot of time in China and India, and there are a whole array of companies in China and India that are extraordinarily sophisticated around the power of pull. We mentioned Li and Feng as one example. They're in the apparel industry. We have examples in the motorcycle industry, consumer electronics industry, financial services, diesel turbines, agricultural products. So we see it across enough different industries where they're creating these scalable pull platforms on a global scale that we believe that's where we need to be looking. And yet very few Western executives even recognize that kind of innovation is going on in China or India. And so it's it's what we call invisible innovation. Our Western executives focus on product and technology innovation. That, to them, is the key. And we say it's a different form of innovation that's going to drive wealth creation going forward.
In fact, we tend to call this other form of innovation institutional innovation. How do you invent completely new types of institutions? If you think about it a moment, what was the innovation in maybe the last couple hundred years that produced more wealth than any other innovation? Interesting thing to think about, okay? And I was on a panel to discuss this, and I'm sure they put me on the panel because they expected me to say the microprocessor. And when it came to my turn, I said, no, it was the limited liability corporation. The institutional innovation that enabled us to be able to amass capital without liability, without extreme liability. That produced more wealth in today's world than anything else, beginning and end of story. And so it was an institutional innovation. But you might wonder, why is China? And people like to say, well, there's something very special about China, the culture or something. And in many ways, the answer is pretty simple. Startups in China or small companies, small businesses in China, don't have access to private equity, at least didn't used to have access to private equity. So they can never get all the money needed to be able to complete the job. And so they have to start out saying, well, you know, I have this idea. I can do this slice of the problem. Now can I find some other small company that wants to join in with me? And so as a startup, where your DNA starts to get formed, so to speak, you start up in the open view, can I actually bring other small companies or even big companies into my tent to enable me to make this thing actually happen? Well, in this country, we have plenty of access to private equity. We're taught focus, focus, focus is the most important thing. Get all the money you need to make it happen. Don't waste any time trying to negotiate all kinds of other companies as being a part of that. Now, I mean, strategic partnership is a different topic. But it's interesting to see how Asia, or in China in particular, has turned a foible, the lack of private equity, into a feature that then has led to kind of an interesting new type of DNA that has stayed in the culture.
Well, Michael, your company, Adaptive Path, just opened a brand new office in Amsterdam. So you guys are betting in a different direction, or are you?
I don't know if it's so much of a different direction. I mean, well, a different direction in the sense of we're not going to Asia, at least not with this studio. Maybe it is a bet in a different direction because of the reasons that we went to Amsterdam. I mean, the classic business rationale is you find a marketplace that you can exploit and you move to exploit that marketplace. But, you know, fundamentally, all of the conversations that started us thinking about, gee, we'd love to open a studio in Amsterdam is, you know, there's some really, really talented people there. In fact, specifically, we would really like to do better work on mobile devices, and we would really like to do better work in service design. And Europe is definitely far ahead of the United States in terms of having talented designers in those two fields. And Europe is definitely behind the United States on designing experiences that are meant to be delivered through the web. So it's something that we can bring to that pool of talented designers. And fundamentally, it's the move to Amsterdam was a move motivated by the desire for creative growth. So maybe that is a different direction. I mean, it's certainly a different way of thinking about why you would move your business.
But it's an interesting example of fusing unique capability here, the experience architecting with mobile experience and architectures, which we're kind of way behind on. And now, so you brought a unique capability here and fused it with the unique capability over there. And that fusing is very interesting.
And so far, I mean, the studio has only been, the studio has been open for about 6 months now. And is doing phenomenally good work. I mean, our people are having a ton of fun.
And passionate, I hope.
Absolutely.
Well, a number of questions here about the international scene, and I'll give one of them. Really, it's how can American companies catch up with foreign companies? And that's one question. A related one is one of our biggest challenges in the U.S. is that our government has become ineffective due to polarization and self-serving behavior. Can the lessons of pull be applied to large-scale social change on major public policy challenges?
So, I mean, the place for certain hope on that particular topic is a program called Gov 2.0. Gov 2.0 is a movement in Washington, although it was spearheaded by Tim O'Reilly out here, to ask, can we actually build, he uses the term pull platforms, that pull citizens into participating in a way that help solve real problems in an amazingly cost-effective way. So let me just give you one example that was just talked about 2 weeks ago. We had the Gov 2.0 summit The second summit, 1.5 weeks ago in Washington. This is an example of saying, like, many of us carry around and take multiple pills. Seniors take even more. and you end up having these boxes of pills, and you can't remember quite which pill is which. So there's a question of how do you actually kind of make pills self-identifying. Now, the PUSH program would change regulations so that you either put an ID card, RFID, that's a joke, inside each pill. That's a, somehow you print total identification on the pill, and you know what that would mean. And here is a scheme that was created. Somebody came up with the idea, and it's called PillBox. And they said, let's take pictures of every pill and the prescription on the bottle along. So now you see a picture of the pill and the prescription. And ask anybody who wants to in the entire country to do that. You know, within a week or two, they get thousands and thousands and thousands of images coming in. And now they build a website that sorts these pictures, indexes these pictures in a way that says, okay, I want my pill is about so big and orange. And then up comes all the images. And you match your pill against that image. And you can, you know, then it has other kind of criteria you go through. So you can do this self-identification. This entire database was built by, you know, people spending 30 seconds, you know, taking a snapshot of the pill and the prescription bottle. And phoning it in. And then, you know, so it was a beautiful example of pulling all this information together. Nobody spent more than, you know, a minute or two doing it, getting everybody to participate who wanted to. You select in, obviously, and now build up this major service. And it just happened. I mean, it happened in a matter of a few weeks.
If I can take one other cut at this this issue, the question addressed the issue of polarization in terms of political discourse, and certainly that is a huge issue and challenge for us today in the U.S. Our hope is that one of the things we would like to see is reframing public policy debates through the lens of talent development, and this is something that most people don't do except in the narrow domain of education policy. We all understand that we've got serious issues with our educational system and how can we reframe public policy around education to develop talent more effectively. We actually believe that as important as education is, it's a small part of the puzzle in terms of talent development. In fact, virtually every public policy under discussion and debate has an implication for talent development, and yet it's rarely even surfaced as an issue. And asking, given all the options in a particular policy domain, whether it's trade policy, immigration policy, intellectual property policy, what are the implications of each of the options in terms of either accelerating talent development or slowing down talent development? It might provide an interesting common ground where we can start to come together as opposed to exist in this polarized world where we instinctively go to our trenches and duke it out, start to focus on talent development as an issue that I think everybody is concerned about, everybody sees huge opportunity around. What if we focus the debate around talent development?
Michael, any ideas around this?
I mean, an idea, but it's a kind of a tangential idea, because what
it's from the edge. You're bringing in an idea from the edge, right?
Well, I mean,
that's good.
One of the things that I heard in that question was how can we transform these kind of old hidebound institutions? You know, I think of governmental structures, the traditional sort of command and control hierarchies. That's pretty much the epitome of the slow moving from the top. Everybody does what it says on page 24 of the regulation manual, and I think that, you know, if we kind of reframe the way we think of organizations as not depending upon managers but depending upon widely distributed acts of leadership,
right.
So and it would be interesting, and this is a bit of a setup, it would be interesting if we think of an organization that actually doesn't have managers. Right? where everybody just has the freedom and the culture is open enough that as long as we can agree to generally work by this set of principles, everybody is free to commit acts of leadership. Very much kind of the underlying philosophy of the open source movement. We actually went through, we are a small and growing firm, we went through something we called growing pains a couple of years ago, where we actually sat down and asked ourselves the question, what structure do we want to be when we grow up? And the answer was, we really don't want to be a structure when we grow up. And instead of coming up with a structure, we came up with, because we're designers, we came up with a set of design principles for what that would feel like, not what it would be or what it would look like. You know, that it would be transparent, that we would have mutual interdependence, that every person would have self-determination. And we agreed that that's how we would govern ourselves or lead ourselves. And now, you know, we're in this position where, you know, most design firms have got creative directors that tell the designers what to do, what to work on, what's good and what's bad. We don't. We're wrestling with that a little bit because we have this tension of, you know, there needs to be some authority, but nobody wants the other person to be the authority. So how do we work with that? And I think that it is this notion of like widely distributed leadership. If you can agree a set of principles and then make sure that people understand that they have the freedom to exhibit leadership and rally other people, and you provide the means of connectivity so that that free flow of communication can happen and people can rally each other. And if they rally off in a different direction than you think that they ought to be rallying, like have the courage to let them rally in that direction. For instance, the Advocate Council, which is the governing body that would be the managers if we had managers, I guess, people who advocate for other individuals in the organization and are elected as a council, they're off reworking our feedback and review process. And I have no idea what they're going to come up with. And they're just doing it. And the rest of the organization trusts them to come up with something that is going to be fair and reflect our values. Well, I trust them.
But, you know, the example we talked about actually before coming up here that I thought was a brilliant move that you make is it is very, very common for somebody in your group to be spending 70% of their time mm-hmm. being the creative director of a project, mm-hmm. but also the other 30% of their time actually working on somebody else's project.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's ironic, the 70-30, no comment really in Fong, but the fact is that, you know, so it's very common for one person to have multiple roles simultaneously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, brings a kind of reciprocity and understanding, you know, both sides of the equation. That kind of changes the whole social dynamics of your place.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program tonight where we have time for only one more question. I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our program tonight is The Power of Pull with John Seely Brown, John Hagel, and Michael Meyer. Okay, I'm going to hit you with a kind of a wild question now. It's not quite like surf music, but it's I think it's a little wild. And then after that, I'd like each of you to maybe make a closing comment. Why are we as human beings still allowing fear to rule our lives? Should we be really afraid of anything, or should we just let go? Now, given that we have two MBAs here and a physicist at the end, and Michael's also a physicist by training, I'm going to start with JSB.
Well, I won't answer it from a surf music point of view, but I do find it interesting. In fact, it's a really great opening story in our book about some extreme surfers. And what's interesting about these extreme surfers who have an amazing passion to get to be extreme surfers, their willingness to throw fear aside, not stupidly, but somewhat, in order to kind of achieve these amazing moves out there. Now, and those of you who surf can understand that things can really go wrong. But even in that context, it is astounding to see how these folks really experiment all the time, throwing a fear away, but makes a lot of sense given the passion that they actually have. So we may be more afraid of fear when we don't have a driving passion.
Mr. Hagel?
I certainly, not surprisingly, would agree with JSB on this. But I would also add that I think that one of the reactions to our book and one of the things that I think individuals particularly feel very reassured about is in a kind of unusual way, we talk about the notion that pressure is mounting. And for most of us, I think if we reflect on our own experiences over the past decade, most of us would say we are more stressed today than we were 10 years ago, and it's not just the downturn, that we were stressed, experiencing increasing stress even before we went into the downturn. And for a lot of people reading the book, it's enormously reassuring to be told that stress is not just in your mind. It's actually out there. The pressure is mounting. So it's not just, you know, a figment of your imagination. And it helps people to ground themselves and say, okay, now I understand there's real reason that this stress is here. Now what do I do about it? And that's where this whole notion, the message around connect with the passion, because the passion will help you to overcome that fear. People who have passion and pursue their passions are naturally much more risk-taking. They don't have as much fear. And if you don't have that passion, you will experience fear because it's a very scary world out there as the pressure mounts. The natural tendency is to want to pull in and batten down the hatches. And that's actually probably the worst thing you can do in this world where knowledge flows are becoming more and more central to success.
Yeah, I would actually say that fear is not a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with being afraid. What's wrong is being afraid of the wrong things, right? If you, as an individual or your people in your organization, are afraid of looking bad in front of the boss, of being offending the boss, of not towing the party line. You know, if you're afraid of being a conformist, if you're afraid of being branded a nonconformist, if you're afraid of doing something politically incorrect, that you're afraid of the wrong things. If you're afraid of not being good enough, if you're afraid of not being able to earn the respect of your peers, I actually think those are good things to be afraid of because they drive you to higher levels of achievement. You know, one of the things that is a very common practice in the design community is the idea of a crit, right? Where you take your work, you stand up in front of all of your peers, you display your work and you defend the thinking and the actions behind it to a group of your peers. And this is a terrifying experience, and it should be a terrifying experience because that drives people to be better designers, to put more thought, more care, more attention into their work. So I think that, you know, having a healthy amount of fear of the right things, of failing in ways that you don't want to fail, there's nothing wrong with that. Being too afraid to do something different, that's a true shame.
Thank you. Now, we're almost out of time, but I need to ask each of our panelists maybe for a closing statement about this, and we'll just maybe go in the same order across the way.
I will build on what you just said, Michael, saying that the wrong kind of fear is the fear that keeps you from being willing to get out of your own rut.
And I guess I would just say that a lot of the conversation today has been around mounting pressure and stress and deteriorating performance. I think there's another side to the book that we probably haven't emphasized enough, which is the enormous opportunity that is created around the power of pull, and particularly for us as individuals. We make the case, and I think hopefully convincingly, that as individuals we have more ability to shape the environments that we're working in today than ever before. And companies have more opportunity to shape the markets and industries they're working in than ever before using the power of pull. So if we understand the techniques and develop the institutions required, there is actually enormous value to be created for all of us. And so we would want to emphasize that.
I would say that a lot of this discussion actually has kind of driven me back or driven me to think back on some of the lessons that I learned as a young naval officer. Because at the time, the Navy was very concerned about developing good leadership in their officer corps. And I think that that's maybe something that we have lost sight of in the last 10 or 20 or 30 years as we've striven to become more highly effective organizations. We've focused on developing organizational structures and making people good managers, but we haven't focused on making people good leaders. And, you know, leaders are the people who inspire other people, who incite other people to take concerted action to get something done. And if we were more concerned about having leaders within our companies and less concerned about having managers within our companies, I think that we'd actually do a lot better stuff.
Well, thank you very much. Our program tonight has been The Power of Pull with John Seely Brown, John Hagel, and Michael Meyer. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club tonight and our audience listening at home. And with this, I'll close our program tonight at the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion. And our program is closed.